This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last week, we had a conversation that most pundits didn't think was going to be necessary. We spent an hour talking about how the Democratic Party could recover from the disaster of the 2016 presidential election. That conversation was the one Republicans were supposed to have in the wake of Donald Trump taking the party hostage and dragging the GOP into the wilderness. Well, we all know how wrong that prognostication proved to be. Trump was wildly successful, and with his success, Republicans seem stronger than ever, but is it the same party? President-elect Trump has certainly taken the party in new and unexpected directions and changed it in some fundamental ways. Mr. Trump also made some promises on the campaign trail that might be difficult to fulfill, some of which he seems to be softening on, and he and his policies are feared by some in the country. Is it a good thing for a political party's policies to be feared? On Sunday's Meet the Press, for instance, Trump's chief of staff, GOP Chairman Reince Priebus, said that President-elect Donald Trump's team is not planning to create a Muslim registry, but he would not rule anything out. So what is next for the Republican Party as we move out into this new era? We talk about that this morning, and we're joined by Dr. Ada Fisher to do so. She is a Republican National Committee woman for North Carolina. She led the effort to register the votes for Donald Trump at this summer's Republican National Convention, and is the author of the book Common Sense Conservative Prescriptions, Solutions for What Ails Us, Book One, which indicates Book Two might be in the works. Is that correct?
Well, it might be, but not anytime soon. I'm trying to recover from this past election.
Okay. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Larry Shaheen is also with us. He's a Republican political consultant and founder and attorney at law at Carolina Political Consulting, which was created in 2010 to help serve the campaign political and legal needs of candidates. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Nice to meet you. Both are in our studio, and joining us by phone once again is Dr. Andrew Taylor, professor of political science at NC State University and the author of a number of books, including Elephant's Edge, The Republicans as a Ruling Party. Dr. Taylor, thank you for being back with us.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Let me begin with Dr. Fisher. In your book, Common Sense Conservative Prescriptions, Solutions for What Ails Us, Book One, you laid out present-day election patterns, if I'm not mistaken. Does that mean that despite what so many others predicted in terms of the outcome of this election and got wrong, you got right?
I got it absolutely right and on the money.
Why do you think that is? How are you so prescient?
I don't know if I was prescient. I was just, you know, calling it as I see it. I spent a lot of time living in rural North Carolina, and I found that the people in rural North Carolina vote a little bit differently and in the urban areas. And one of the things I know about the Electoral College is the Electoral College is spread out over the whole entire nation to make sure there's not an imbalance between urban areas and rural areas. And when I looked at that, I said, this man and anybody who understands politics can win the election if they appreciate where rural America, the mountains, and these areas that are neglected are coming from. So having spent probably 20 years dealing with those types of communities, I had a fairly good idea of how people felt. I'm also a preacher's kid, and one of the things that happened in this particular election was the evangelical vote came out in support of Donald Trump. And people would ask why, given all that we heard. And I was interviewed by Norwegian and some other people, and they said, how can you do this? PBS said, in view of your religious background, I'm Jewish, how would I support Donald Trump? And I said, you ever heard of King David? I mean, King David had to be the greatest sinner there was, and yet he was a remarkable king, and God chose him, a very flawed individual, to lead. And I saw some of that coming up in the evangelical community as it related to Donald Trump. People were willing to forgive a whole lot of things if you just said you're going to do something different and give me the religious freedom to be who I am and represent what I believe.
Hmm. You also said in January, don't be too sure people aren't going to vote for Trump based on polls. Once again, you were right. Is that because the pollsters weren't talking to the right people, because people wouldn't tell the truth to pollsters, that they didn't? Why?
Well, several things. One of the people that I know quite well and knew quite well was Jesse Helms. Mm-hmm. And Jesse Helms used to always say, polls don't vote, people vote. And when I went through Salisbury and drive down the highways, I didn't see any Hillary Kane stickers on cars. Didn't see that many Trump stickers either. And so what I came to the conclusion was people didn't want to show their hand in terms of who they're going to vote for. I know I've lost friends and family because of my support for Donald Trump. And I'm going, you all don't understand the process. You don't understand what America stands for. And the presidential candidate must speak to the whole nation. There are those who say because he didn't get the popular vote, he doesn't do that. And I'm going, that's hogwash. The popular vote reflects urban populations, but it neglects those areas of the country that we need to have represented.
Can we talk about that for a second, Dr. Taylor? Because she said a couple of things. What she just said about doesn't represent the whole country, the popular vote. But she also said when we were talking about the Electoral College that there is an imbalance which is addressed by and corrected by the Electoral College in terms of raising the representation of people in rural America over the urban areas of the country. The big debate, and we're going to have it in about an hour on the Diane Rehm Show about the Electoral College. Is that an accurate statement? Why should we raise the influence of rural people when there are fewer of them and when more people are thinking in a different direction? And this before you answer that, Dr. Taylor, this is also affecting this imbalance affects legislatures around the country where rural interests are more, particularly here
in North Carolina,
are more represented than urban areas. So go ahead and take a shot at that.
Yeah, well, with regards to Electoral College really, it's not necessarily rural areas that it provides a voice for, but smaller states.
Right,
that's correct.
So the Electoral College. The distribution of electoral votes is based upon the size of the state's representation in the Congress, which, of course, is the number of House seats plus two. Every state gets two seats for the Senate, which was an effort at the Constitutional Convention to blend what Madison called national and federal interests. Mm-hmm. Federal interests are obviously expressed in the Senate, the national interest purely by population in the House, and the Electoral College is a mix of the two. And it just happens that A lot of the smaller states today are rural, but they're not exclusively. I mean, we have some urban small states like Delaware and Rhode Island are good examples of small states that are very urbanized.
Mm-hmm.
But it is for whatever reason the case that smaller states tend to be more rural, and this is where you get this sort of sense that the Electoral College takes into account the views of people in those areas. If you took the Electoral College away, for example, think about where the candidates would campaign.
Right.
They would go where there is a large number of votes close to where they're standing at any one point in time. And, of course, what Donald Trump did was he really did go to small-town areas. You just have to look at where he went in North Carolina when he campaigned down here. He did come to Raleigh. He was in Charlotte a bit. But unlike Secretary Clinton, he did go to those small towns and he did go to those rural areas.
Yep.
Not necessarily because of the Electoral College, but because those were people who really wanted to hear his message and clearly responded to him.
So, Larry Shaheen, you sounded a little surprised when we started about Donald Trump's victory. It was kind of a whirlwind, and you certainly wouldn't be the only person in the country who was surprised by his victory. But what does this mean? Given the fact that all the pundits were saying that we were going to have this conversation about how you're going to rebuild this crippled, destroyed party of yours, and now it's completely the opposite.
That's right.
What does his victory mean?
Well, first of all, we have to look at this from a national perspective and understand that the major difference that occurred in this election was there was a shift, and it was primarily in the Rust Belt. And my family came here to Charlotte in 1985 originally from Detroit, so I remember the stories of being told of the downfall of areas in Michigan, mm-hmm. areas in Ohio, Pennsylvania, areas like in Wisconsin where they're losing factories and jobs. And one of the things that I think a lot of folks aren't realizing was that Hillary Clinton – really thought that a lot of those union areas were going to stay with her,
yeah.
even though her message primarily talked about continuing a globalized economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that for those of us here in Charlotte, we have seen the economy continue to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. But Mecklenburg County is one of only 15 counties that from 2008 to 2014 across an annualized basis that we've seen a decrease in unemployment. There have been 85
Unemployment is down across the country.
Well, it's down across the country, but in terms of a grand total. There are a whole number of counties in this entire state. Just from 2014 now, it's all gone down, but it hasn't gone down as much in rural America.
But is that the result of political policies and politicians, or is it the result of the evolution of the economy and where manufacturing, et cetera, is going?
That's actually exactly the right point there, Mike. And here's the reason why you saw this huge shift. The Democratic Party has traditionally been so strong in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, primarily because they supported the unions that supported the workers.
Right.
Well, the problem was that there was a dichotomy within that party. That party had a problem with the idea that they were trying to support globalized economies that were being supported by folks in Los Angeles and Chicago and New York and all these other areas. But the policies that are being supported by those folks are not necessarily helping the folks in Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So there was a natural split. And Donald Trump, whether he intended to or not, actually took advantage of that split and had a whole bunch of folks go out and vote for him. And because of Hillary Clinton's unfavorables and the fact she wasn't speaking to them, they didn't go vote for her.
So you didn't answer my original question, which is, what does this mean for the Republican Party?
Well, it means the Republican Party is going to be far more populist, in short.
Okay.
Far more populist, far less globalized, mm-hmm. and a party that's going to be hopefully far more responsive to those folks who need more work in rural parts of America.
You've been a Republican for a long time, Dr. Fisher,
over
right?
50 years, though I'm only 21 years old.
Okay. So I've heard Republican apparatchiks at the national level. One was asked on television a couple of weeks ago, how would you describe Donald Trump? And they said, moderate Democrat. Does it worry you that Mr. Trump is not really a Republican?
Well, he is a Republican in the sense that he's registered as a Republican. You know, I tell people all the time when they try to split Republicans out, I say, I'll take anybody, rhinos, dinos, winos. We'll take anybody as a Republican who says they're Republican. I think you're splitting hairs. The other thing that I don't think people have wanted to talk about was the Trump immigration stance is really intriguing, particularly in North Carolina and down east, where we have a lot of people who are illegal immigrants in this state. And we have some policies which favor people who are not citizens. And one of the things that Trump
What policies?
There are policies, I think it's called the H2S policy, which has to do with migrant workers that
HB1.
Obama put, HB1, is
HB1
that what
uses, yeah.
And what that policy says, if you hire an illegal immigrant, you've got to pay him more than the minimum wage. You provide housing, you provide transportation, whereas people in the state who work can't get any of this stuff provided for them. So people are a little tired of that. They want to see citizens put first. And though Trump talks about America's
But there
first,
must be a need for those people. Otherwise, an employer wouldn't do all those extra things.
I think you give employers far too much credit. I lived in eastern North Carolina, and most of the people that had initially been brought in were paid below minimum wages. And because they were provided low minimum wages, people could come in. If you had to pay somebody $7.50 an hour, then you could hire citizens to do this. They were paying people as little as $2 and $4 an hour in some of the farm areas, and that's just wrong. I think everybody ought to be able to work for minimum wage, and if citizens don't want to work for minimum wage, then you cut some other benefits. But if they will work for minimum wage, then you can supplement them. And I think that Trump talks about riding the ship where we put citizens first, and that's been my concern all along.
A lot of people would say it's a misconception that we don't put citizens first.
Well, they'd be wrong. I can give you a whole lot of instances.
All right. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more of this conversation with the Republican Party. Obviously, in a good direction, according to Dr. Fisher. So we're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina's Healthcare System's Levine Children's Hospital, delivering comprehensive pediatric care in a kid-friendly environment, giving you the care you demand when it's your child. And Discovery Place Science, presenting life in 13th century Mongolia with the new exhibition Genghis Khan, featuring the battlegrounds and marketplaces of a vanished world. More than 200 objects on display. Tickets at discoveryplacescience.org. Stop the presses used to mean major breaking news was unfolding. Well, now it's taken on a darker meaning. More than 120 newspapers across the country have stopped their presses. and closed up shop. Traffic on newspapers' digital platforms is up, that's true, but not enough to offset the decline in print, which raises concerns about the future of journalism in a democracy. We're going to talk about that with a journalist leading an effort to remedy this alarming trend tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, Donald Trump's victory is the second time in 16 years the president of the United States has been elected without winning the popular vote. This has raised questions about the Electoral College, understanding how we elect the president, and whether the system needs to change.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party in the wake of Donald Trump's victory in the recent election with Dr. Andrew Taylor, professor of political science at NC State University, Larry Shaheen, GOP political consultant and founder of Carolina Political Consulting, and Dr. Ada Fisher, a Republican National Committee woman and author of Common Sense Conservative Prescriptions. Dr. Fisher, in an article that she wrote for the Salisbury Post following the election, said that the media was dumbfounded and still doesn't get it, nor does the Democratic Party and purveyors of liberal thought in America. And in that same article, went on to say that conservatives who jumped on the Trump bandwagon of change may have gotten more than they bargained for. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a we'll see kind of thing. I think that we have no idea what some of these things will play out as being. You know, the Republicans have talked about these things, but now we have the power to do those things. We have the House, we have the Senate, and we'll have the presidency. Now we've got to put up a shut up, and it will call attention to what we believe and what we're standing for. I think we will see some changes on many fronts. But you talked about the direction of the Republican Party. There are some things we have to do. We do have to continue to try to diversify the party. We need more people of color in the party. We need more young people in the party. We need more people that I see with a scientific bent in the party. We are perceived as being anti-environmentalists, which I'm not. I'm a biology major. Love the movie Arrival. If you haven't seen it, you need to see it. But I think that we need to expand the perception that people have of us, because we're not all locked in a shelter, anti-this and anti-that. We love this country, and we need to express that.
Dr. Taylor, this sounds not only like a revolution for the country, it sounds like a revolution within that party, within the GOP. How would you describe it? If she's right about this, how would you describe this?
Yeah, no, I think revolution's as good a descriptor as any. The one thing that Trump has done is to really, he would have done it in defeat, and he's certainly going to do it in victory, is to really make the Republican Party think a little bit about its future, and possibly, even in the White House, he might be unable to avoid this, possibly create civil war might be too much of an exaggeration, but certainly there's going to be some divides. Trump in the campaign, and as Dr. Fisher said, we've got to see what happens, but certainly in the campaign, he suggested pushing forward some policies that are really going to challenge some of the core principles that Republicans have had over the last 20, 30, 40 years, possibly since Ronald Reagan became president in 1981. And that would be that markets tend to be a good institution that you want to rely on. Certainly in terms of the global economy, Donald Trump doesn't believe that. He believes that we should renege on trade agreements and certainly not enter into any more. He doesn't really believe in the free flow of, as well as goods and services across borders. He's not big into the free flow of people across borders as well. And that's going to be a significant change to current Republican orthodoxy. He's not talking about reforming entitlement programs, which threaten to really hurt our financial future and make the budget go even more into debt. And that's something the Republicans, like President George W. Bush, like current Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, have said have been things that we really need to attend to.
Larry Shaheen.
So it could be this. You know, even in victory, we're not. I think we're still on the verge of significant divisions in the party.
Larry Shaheen, this sounds like the Democrats, if they were to disavow FDR's New Deal and say, all that's wrong, all that's gone, we're moving on in a different direction. Is that what this is?
Well, what I think we're seeing is the evolution of the Republican Party into the next chapter of its existence. And primarily one of the things that we're seeing is that, especially here in North Carolina, we've seen the Republican Party become far more interested in making sure that the folks in rural North Carolina, and now we're going to see rural or left behind rusted America being taken care of.
Are just different.
Yeah, I think that's what they're talking about.
How,
now, if they
how,
do it, that's going to be interesting.
How are you going to take care of them?
See, that's the question, though. Where, what are the policies going to be? And you talk about where we're going to go. Well, we're going to have to see that, because this is one of the areas where we're going to have to figure out, how are we going to help North Carolina's rural folks, or America's rural and left behind folks in the Rust Belt, and still be able to provide the need, the ability to allow cities and large urban areas to continue to thrive. I think a good example of that is right here in Charlotte. Charlotte in the last legislative session faced an issue of sales tax redistribution. They beat it back with a coalition of rural Republicans and urban Republicans. Now, they're going to probably see that again here in this long session. And the question's going to be, can our country work together to find a way to continue to be a leader in the corporate world while still making sure that those folks who are, unfortunately, because of either increased automation or jobs leaving or whatever you want to call it, how are we going to provide economically for folks who get left behind as the economy changes? And the Republican Party, like Dr. Taylor said, they don't really talk about that a lot, which I think is going to be interesting, because you've got Republicans like Paul Ryan, you've got Leader Mitch McConnell, who are talking about wanting to do the same policy agenda items that they've been talking about for the last 6 years. And like Dr. Fisher said, they better go ahead and do it, and they better figure out a way to make it happen. Yeah. Without offending all those folks that decided to change parties and vote for Donald Trump in areas that have not supported Republicans in a long time.
Because if they were angry before, they'll really be angry.
That's exactly
in four
right.
years.
That's exactly
if
right.
nothing changes. And the problem is, American manufacturing is not recently in decline.
That's correct.
In fact, it's not in decline at all. American manufacturing still continues. It's just doing it with robots.
That's correct.
And automation.
That's correct.
So that's something I don't think any politician, any political party, any government policy can really change, can
well,
it?
I think that you can have an influence. One of the things that they said, I heard said, was that we wanted to renege on the trade agreement. That's not what I heard Donald Trump say. What I heard him say is there are trade agreements which disadvantage American workers. And we really need to look at those and say, do those policies work in our best interest? People talk about what will be the future. I have two kids. They told me they didn't want to go to college. I said, thank you, Lord. I don't have to pay for that. But you better be able to provide for yourself in terms of a job, some place to live, because mama's house is no longer the place. And so then they were hit with realities. What happens? Well, we see a whole generation of kids moving back home. And the question is, what kind of jobs? We see people say, well, there are no jobs. There are jobs, but they're not the jobs that these kids want to do.
It's a service economy.
Yeah.
We've gone from manufacturing to selling McDonald's hamburgers.
So the question is, how do we get this generation retrofitted for the future?
Well, that leads me to this, and I'm not sure who should answer this question, but it seems to me that if manufacturing is declining in terms of the number of people it employs, not in terms of its output, because productivity is the highest it's ever been, that means goods are being manufactured robotically and through automation. Where more people are moving into the service industry, which is minimum wage jobs or jobs with no health care or benefits, things like health care service workers who come to your house and take care of your elderly mother, they are out there in the cold and they don't have unions to protect them. Shouldn't the focus be on those kinds of jobs as opposed to jobs in the manufacturing sector, which are not coming back?
Well, and this is actually the question that needs to be asked, not just in North Carolina but across the country. I think you're right about one thing, that we do need to talk about how to better transition folks into a service economy. And this is where I think you'll see Republicans, hopefully, move in the direction of a type of program like we see in Germany, where there's a type of education program for folks that lose their jobs and then are able to go to
community
college.
But there are also strong unions in Germany.
Oh, there are strong unions.
And one of the things that built the middle class from the Industrial Revolution through the present day were strong unions and their identification with Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans have never liked strong unions because Republicans have traditionally been the party of business, and business don't want unions. They want to get the most out of they can out of their employees. So how do you do that? How do you help this whole new sector of service employees who have no union representation in an atmosphere where unions are the boogeyman.
Well, I'm going to actually push
and
back.
Give them the middle class life that their parents.
I agree with you the fact that we need to focus on how to do service jobs. But there's one area that we have to talk about that where we can actually make a real difference, and that is small business industrial. How do we encourage entrepreneurial industrial growth? How do we find the next Thomas Edison? How do we find the next person that's going to do what Tesla did? How are we going to find those people? Well, it has to start early, of course, with good education, and it has to start with good focus on STEM. But we can remove regulations on the start of industrial businesses, and we can find ways to help encourage those types of growth so that we don't see these types of great jobs that are – these great innovations that we see out in China and India. And you know where it starts, Mike? With strong support for our university systems that then in turn create incubators for engineering and science and math and create all types of new industrial opportunities to employ individuals.
Well, I would disagree with some of that because the governor had something that they haven't moved off of first base the way I think it ought to be. We need to go back and put some things back in high school. We now have to go to community colleges to learn to be brick masons and some things that you don't need a college degree to learn how to do. So we need to put it back in high schools because these kids then don't have to pay extra money to get that level of thing. But I think if you really want to change the die, you got to look at what is it that those people who are maids and service workers don't get. And one of the things they don't get is benefits. And we need to come up with a different way of looking at benefits. I think that it would be behooved the banks and financial institutions to create an independent benefits package for people that they can buy into and participate in. One of my biggest concerns, if you read that article I wrote, is Social Security. Social Security is the booby trap out there. We are using people's Social Security money to finance every darn thing in this nation, from wars, etc. And that's not what that money was for. That money should go back to Al Gore's concept, put it in a lockbox, and let's then see what it is we need to run this country. And what we're going to find out is we don't have the money there because people haven't put the taxes in to do those kinds of benefits. But if I could put my own benefits aside and get something out of it, I think we could grow the economy differently in that way. And we create jobs in the financial industry.
So, Dr. Taylor, is the GOP set up to serve this new coalition of people that have come into the fold, these people who have been disenfranchised by Democrats because industry has gone away and manufacturing jobs have gone away, and this rising number of people in the service industry who work for minimum wage and no benefits? Are they set up to serve those people and their traditional coalition of business?
Well, you know, I might be showing my stripes a little bit here, Mike, but I think Republican policies can do it. I'm not sure whether Donald Trump's policies can do it. I mean, what we really need, and Larry sort of hit on this a bit, is that we need growth. And growth is going to be the key here, I think, in terms of just winning people over into the Republican fold and obviously helping this country navigate some of its great problems it has going forward. And I don't think that building walls is going to be the way to do that. I don't think, and I know Dr. Fisher sort of said that I over-exaggerated when I said that the Trump administration will renege on trade agreements. That may be true, but certainly not going to be open to future trade agreements. I don't think that's the way to get growth. You know, much of the problems that we've been talking about are, as you noted in the questions, Mike, I think, are a function of the way the world's changed rather than policy instruments. And I think the two candidates who really did well in this election, obviously Donald Trump, but the other one is Bernie Sanders. Both of them, in my view, were suggesting that that they had a time machine on offer rather than were able to change policy. Both of them were hearkening back to days in the past when we remember that things were better than we think they are now. That's not going to work. We need the policies in place to be able to move forward. And the first thing we need is economic growth. So I do think that there's going to be a tremendous debate within the Republican Party, particularly if in the first couple of years of the Trump administration we don't get that turnaround as to whether that model really works.
That's right.
And that it's a growth-driven model that lifts all boats is going to be the better way to go.
You set off a firestorm, Dr. Fisher, when you talked about immigration and visas and things like that. We have a couple of emails I want to read to you. Kelsey writes, Dr. Fisher just mentioned H-1B visas and worded it as a law that makes people hiring illegal immigrants pay more money than they would an American citizen. That is not correct. This visa is intended to protect migrant workers from being taken advantage of. This bill was passed in response to the overwhelming need for additional workers in the area of farming and day laboring, both for undocumented and legal citizens. Heather in Belmont says, framing the immigrant situation in North Carolina as if they receive huge benefits not afforded to others is disingenuous at best. I noticed that no mention was made of HB 318, which McCrory signed in 2015. Please ask the chairwoman about this bill, which is widely considered as one of the harshest anti-immigrant bills in the country, and how she syncs that with her contention that immigrants in this state have it made.
I never said immigrants have it made. And I think that one of the disingenuous parts of the conversation is we don't want to talk about immigration and the impact upon the nation. I worked for the Martin Marietta Energy Systems, which is part of the Department of Energy, and I was the psychological backup for terrorist training. One of the things that I think that Trump has pointed out, and rightfully so, is that terrorism is real. And you've got to have some way to screen people who come in this country, whether they be migrant workers or people who are coming in as refugees. And that's a hard thing to do. They have stepped back and walked back on this thing of we are going to have registries, et cetera. One of the people that Trump recently hired as his chief of staff is Rance Priebus. I've known Mr. Priebus for 8 years, and he's kind of an interesting guy, to say the least. But I think that he is a balanced guy, and he's a risk-averse guy to some degree. He wants to do what is politically correct and keep people in the fold. One of the things—
Some of the other people he's appointing are not balanced guys. If you look at it, at least from the liberal point of view, you got somebody who's in charge, who's going to be in charge of national security, who advocates waterboarding.
Well— I'm not getting Again. Into that because I know that terrorism is a tough thing and how you deal with that. But
And others, there are other people that are not balanced. You got this guy, Steve Bannon, who ran Breitbart News. Breitbart News is a website that really is, that does cater to white supremacists. And I think that is,
let's be fair and balanced. I mean, Hillary Clinton talked a lot about Byrd, who was from West Virginia. He used to be the imperial dragon for the Ku Klux Klan. So we got people all around
used to
us.
Be. But that was a long time ago.
We got people all around the world and all kinds of things.
Let's get back to HB 318. Right. Let's get back to that because I think that's an actual topic that should be discussed. And it's an example of part of the problems that we're seeing in terms of these political issues. Uh-huh. HB 318 prohibited sanctuary cities. That was simply very simple what it was. It did not allow North Carolina cities to pass laws that were that were different than what the federal immigration laws or what the federal the state laws were. That's the same kind of problem that we have is that you've got this rural-urban divide that's starting to become far more in focus. And we in Charlotte have got to understand that moving forward, we have to be a far more balanced approach here to understanding the differences between rural and urban North Carolina.
Okay. With that, we have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about some of the fears that are coordinating – well, not coordinating, but fears that come along with Donald Trump's election on the parts of many people, including African-Americans, Dr. Fisher.
Well, I'm African-American.
I know you are. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about this in a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gardner-Webb University, a private Christian liberal arts experience dedicated to preparing students for success around the corner and around the world. Ignite your future at gardner-webb.edu. Donald Trump's victory is the second time in 16 years that the President of the United States has been elected without winning the popular vote. Now, this has raised questions, of course, about the Electoral College. So, on the Diane Rehm Show, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, understanding how we elect the president and whether the system needs to change. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation about the future of the Republican Party in the wake of Donald Trump's victory, you can do so at Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
May 3rd, 1971, the first broadcast of All Things Considered. Since then, a lot has changed, but what hasn't is that we bring the news of the day to life through sound. Listen every afternoon.
Hear the latest news from NPR, plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30, weekends at 5 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the future of the Republican Party under a Donald Trump presidency with Dr. Ada Fisher, Republican National Committee Woman from North Carolina, Larry Shaheen, a GOP political consultant, and Dr. Andrew Taylor, professor of political science at NC State University. There's a lot of fear out there in the country because of this election and because of the winner of this election. And let's start with African Americans, because you, as you have pointed out, are an African American and have been one for quite some time, Dr. Fisher. this is not new for you.
Yeah. Old news.
He has, Mr. Trump has, appointed as an advisor Steve Bannon, who used to run Breitbart News. And the question is, some people find that as, well, that, and we have an email here from Dennis that says, so with David Duke's endorsement and a Trump victory celebration by the Ku Klux Klan, is this the new direction of the GOP? Is this guy who used to run Breitbart News an indication that either Mr. Trump is embracing, either being embraced by or ignoring the influence of this strain of thought in America?
I don't think that it's an embrace or ignoring that. That exists. I think what it is you can't tell anybody who to vote for. I went to the Sons of the Confederacy and had a great conversation with them. And people say, well, why do you go there? I said, they vote. They have to be represented, and you have to hear what they have to say. I don't have to agree with
it. But you can't stop who votes for you, but you can stop who you put in the administration. So does having Steve Bannon as the Karl Rove of the Trump administration in the White House reflect the values of the party of Lincoln?
I don't think that Steve Bannon is in the role of a Karl Rove. He has strategic information that he's given him. I don't know Steve Bannon, but I do know Ada Fisher, and I know that I probably send more emails to the Republican administration of Donald Trump than anybody saying I agree, I disagree, but I can't control what people do. Now, one of the things that people have talked about is fear. You know, Donald Trump, as far as I remember, he's the first person who has said, I'm concerned about the inner cities. Everybody has talked about it, but very few people have done about it.
And he also said, what do you got to lose by voting for me? Well, and that ticked off a lot of people in the African-American community, apparently not you.
Doesn't tick me off. People need to get over themselves. I mean, we're faced with a president who cut out the small regional businesses for the SBA, which funded black communities. We are faced with a president right now who cut the amount of money to the PLUS loan program that eliminated 35,000 students of color from education. We're faced with a president who's black, who I can't see has done a whole lot for the black community except for being black. So I think that we need to look at, on the face, what are the issues that we want to deal with? If the Republican Party doesn't deal with something that people don't like, then they need to complain about it, which people are doing. And I complain about a whole lot of things and try to affect some change. But one of the things that we have to do is you can't complain about a party if you're not participating. People say, well, why are you there? We need black input into the Republican Party. I'm there. I try to give black input. I try to give white input. I try to give input from rural America where I've been. And I try to give all kinds of input.
Why are you a Republican?
I am a Republican because I believe in smaller government. I believe in limited government in that respect. I believe that people need to have the government do for them what they can't do for themselves. I believe in personal responsibility. I am a Republican because I believe that it is the best representative to get things done. I wrote a booklet on African Americans in the Republican Party in North Carolina. And in 1866, a guy named Wilson Carey said, one of the problems for blacks is when immigrants come and displace blacks from different things. That's no different from what I'm hearing now. That was in 1866. We are now in 2016. I am a Republican because the Republican Party in North Carolina was founded by blacks as well as white.
Let's go back to talking about Donald Trump again, because he made a lot of statements during the campaign that offended a lot of people and shocked a lot of people. And he said things about other Republicans, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, John Kasich.
He went through the
whole list and destroyed them, essentially, ran roughshod over them. Mm-hmm. Can you rebuild that? Can a Paul Ryan take the reins as the Speaker of the House and work with Donald Trump?
I think so. And I think one of the key things that you saw come out of this election was that you saw Paul Ryan and Donald Trump get together. And, you know, I've heard a story from several of our local congressmen, and they've been talking about how when Donald Trump came to speak to their conference, you know, they applauded and they were very happy when he came in. But it was rudimentary. It was the same kind of applause that someone gets when, you know, they come and speak. But when they left, There was standing room only applause. It was standing applause because he embraced the changes that the GOP conference wants to do. And this is the thing where you've got a lot of crazy things happens in elections. And everybody comes back together and now has to govern. And the thing that's going to ultimately make the difference is whether or not the congressmen and senators can come together with Donald Trump to find a way to sell policies that not only advance their agendas but also help make sure that there's a continuation of this type of message that Donald Trump has used. There has to be focus on entrepreneurial growth in this country. There has to be a deregulation of the type of regulations that keep businesses down. And in terms of how we can best
give me
help
an
the
example of a regulation. That
Let's talk
keeps
about Dodd Frank.
Down.
Let's talk about Dodd Frank. Dodd Frank's an exact perfect response to that. Do you realize that Dodd Frank, one of the things that it limits small banks from making loans to businesses because you have to make sure that you check all the boxes and there's a certain amount of requirement for capital. So the issue is –
What's wrong with that? That came about after the financial meltdown.
But here's the thing. At some point, there has to be some risk. There does. And at the end of the day, there's no
box. Who assumes the risk?
The bank should assume the risk. The bank should assume the risk, and it should be able to say, and it should
be
able to have.
So there should be different rules for smaller banks.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because that's the biggest problem in rural America. There's no capital.
In black America, many of the small black banks had to go under with Dodd-Frank because they made them absorb. In Mechanics and Farmers Bank right here in Charlotte had to absorb the bank in Greensboro. It absorbed the bank in Durham. It absorbed a lot of things.
Donald Trump advocates may be bringing back part of Glass-Steagall, which was repealed and allowed banks to become both retail organizations and investment organizations.
That should be immediately reinstated. That's the one. Glass-Steagall absolutely.
So under that, what happens to the Bank of
America?
To Bank of America?
We have to do a small version of what Teddy Roosevelt did, which said, look, folks, you can't be trading investment-wise with commercial money. You have to have commercial banks whose roles
are. So you can still have these big banks, but
there has to be a firewall. You can't risk commercial money on investments. And at the end of the day, what we have to get back to is this idea that we shouldn't always be able to fund. You can't just fund things that are going to be able to make you 50, 60, 70% money back. We've got to find those banks that are willing to make the 15% return on investment loan to industrial or small business that's going to allow us to create more jobs in this country.
So, Dr. Taylor, a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump said they didn't take him literally, that the problem with liberals was that they took him literally. So if people didn't take him literally, but they liked what he said overall, what will they be disappointed in, particularly if he can't accomplish it, if he doesn't get it done?
Well, I don't know whether that literally or not is the way I would think about it, but I think what Trump tapped into was a deep sense of despair and about the future. A deep sense of discontent about where things are going in this country, a desire for change. And they saw that he represented that more than did Hillary Clinton. My sense is that, you know, there wasn't really a lot of focus on some of the specific things that Trump administration would do. In fact, even the Trump campaign really stayed away from policy specifics as much as they possibly could. Obviously, there was talk in that regard on issues like immigration and trade, tax policy to a large extent as well. But beyond that, there really weren't that many specifics. And so, in some ways, they don't have any specifics to be disappointed about. But in many ways,
he's going to build a wall, and Mexico's going to pay for it, and he's already backed off from that. So, are they going to be disappointed in that?
But in general, Mike, I think the problem for Trump is that the expectations for significant change are so high. I'm not talking about in terms of specifics, but I'm talking in terms of outcomes. and that I don't believe that anybody really has, at least in a four-year period, the policy instruments at their disposal that can change the country in the way that he said it was going to change. In one regard, because you just can't do that, but secondly, because I think he's fighting against massive tectonic shifts in the way the world works. And he's promising that, one, he can change them, I don't think he can, and two, that changing them would actually be a good thing, which I personally don't agree. So, I mean, I think the real problem for Trump isn't delivering on the specifics, like a wall, like trade deals, but is actually creating growth and market change
what I hear, the way we think we're going.
And I don't know whether that's going to happen.
What I hear Dr. Taylor saying is that if the economic benefits of an increased economy are transferred to the middle and lower classes and we see a rise in their situation, they won't care about the specifics.
But I see something different. Yeah. You know, people are talking about change. One of the things that I can say is this was a test water case for America, because finally what I consider, quote, the people who feel themselves called deplorables, et cetera, they came out and voted and changed the die of America. And that in itself was a significant change. The people never thought these folks were going to come from out.
Didn't the same thing happen with Mr. Obama when he was running in 2008?
No, I don't think it did. I mean, one of the things that
That's
happened.
That's how he got elected.
Well, but he got a coalition of a lot of different people. Trump didn't get a coalition of a lot of different people. He got some people who didn't show up, et cetera. And those people who call themselves the silent majority, and evangelical vote is something that people sort of missed. And one other point. You talked about how he get those people to come together. It's fascinating to me that Romney went to talk to Trump. It's fascinating Ted Cruz went to talk to Trump, because these are people that people said he had disrespected, et cetera, and yet they came to talk to him, because now the man is going to be president. We have to bring everybody to the table to see what they have to say. And I think he'll be far more inclusive than people give him credit for.
He and other Republicans, and Republicans have tried to do this numerous times already, want to repeal and replace Obamacare. You are a general practitioner.
No, I'm not. I'm a family doctor who practiced corporate medicine for 20 years.
All right. So as a doctor, is there nothing good about the Affordable Care Act?
I think the Affordable Care Act was a decent concept. But one of the things I remember, Nancy Pelosi said, we have to pass it before I can let you read it. And if people had read it first, they would have come at it at a different way. I think that people like no penalties for pre-existing conditions. People like the ability to keep kids on insurance till they're 26. But what people don't like is what the benefits are. For example, I had a stroke. And when I had the stroke, I had 9 weeks of rehab. If you have Medicaid, Medicare, and Obamacare, your rehab is only allowed for 3 visits. There are some things in there that we need to look about. It may be affordable, but affordable to whom? Affordable in terms of dollars, or affordable in terms of quality outcome and what you want to see there? And I think it's very flawed in that respect. Mm. Now, what will we replace it with? You read my book. I got a whole section in there about some options we can look at for health care.
Can't read your book now, but I do have a minute. You can go.
Well, one of the things I get very concerned about is people are talking about health savings account. My understanding of health savings accounts is they're good when you got a job, but for people who don't have a job, how are we going to compensate and provide services for them? I also think that the Affordable Care Act gets rid of physicians and patients as the center of the equation. What ends up happening is the insurance companies determine what people can get, and I'm definitely not.
What about Medicare for everybody, then?
I don't believe in Medicare because I don't think they provide good benefits. And the other thing is, you talk about it.
Well, then fix it.
Who's paying for this? Where's the money coming from? Remember, I told you this money comes out of Social Security, et cetera.
All right.
And I don't believe that we ought to be doing it that
way. One of the ways to put people back to work is doing what Mr. Trump says about improving our infrastructure.
I would agree with that.
I think he wants to do $1 trillion in infrastructure improvements, which would be a good thing for people who want to go back to work.
Right.
And probably a good thing for the country overall. Where does that money come from if you're also going to cut taxes and fight ISIS and wage war in Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera?
Well,
Where's that money going to come from?
Let me give a humble suggestion to the Trump administration. We've got what, $36 trillion in offshore profits for all of these companies that haven't been able to bring it back to the United States. I think it's time for the president to cut a deal. It's time to cut a deal. Cut a deal with these folks and say, look, you bring this stuff back. You bring it back. You give it to your investors. We'll cut you a deal on it. One-time deal. And that one-time deal, that pays for your infrastructure investment because you've got a tax on each of those repatriated profits, which then in turn funds your infrastructure development. You're done. At that point, you're done. And that's one of those kind of deals that post-peaks will look like, oh, wait, that kind of makes sense. Yeah, it does, because that's one of those areas where – and this is coming from a developer's kid. My father does industrial development. I grew up doing industrial development. You got to cut a deal. You got to find a way to look for other sources of income like that, like being able to find free market solutions for healthcare, like being able to think outside the box. And I say this because there are a lot of folks that are trusting Donald Trump to do a lot of things differently. And I hope that he does because at the end of the day, we have to remember this election was not won for Donald Trump by the Republican Party or the Republican grassroots organization. It wasn't. To be honest with you, it was not very good. This election was won primarily because of him. And it was him and his message and his brand and his drive. And he pulled people up who had no business winning. And he's the one who's driving the ship.
So, Dr. Taylor, I have less than a minute left. But before this election, everybody was saying we were going to have this conversation about how to rebuild the Republican Party and would there be a future for Republicans and what would it mean in the wake of the disastrous failure of Donald Trump to win this election. Obviously, that's a conversation that we're not having or we're never going to have.
Amen.
What happens if he's successful to Republicans? What does the party look like then? What happens if he's not? And I have literally 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, if he's not, I think in many ways he might be an aberration, with the exception that Republicans need to start focusing on those folks that Dr. Fisher and Larry have been talking about throughout the course of the conversation. If he's successful, then his effect on the party is much more profound than that. And it may well be that we start to lose the Republicans' focus on things such as free markets and individual liberties, and it becomes a different kind of party.
And with that, I have to stop you. We never got to talk about the governor's race, which I'm sure you're happy about. Dr. Andrew Taylor, professor of political science at NC State, Larry Shaheen, political consultant, and Dr. Ada Fisher, Republican National Committee woman. Thank you all.